This is Rhode Island's longest running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Soa, delighted to have you joining us here on AM 790, your home of talking business. Now, I don't know specifically what the market will use as an excuse for its up and down movements, but, you know, the word today says that, well, you know, given that the president does have a key speech that he's going to be giving tomorrow evening, Tuesday night, that, you know, maybe the markets are, I don't know, there's not a lot out there that would have them speculate about it, so maybe they're just hopeful that the president will put a little meat on the bone of a number of issues that have been part of the overall Washington-based conversation. For the speech tomorrow night, people are looking to maybe hear more details about some of the policies that the administration and, of course, the House of Representatives, the Congress, will be wrestling with. Analysts are suggesting that up to this point, he's delivered on the types of campaign promises that the president can do with executive orders, which are among the easier ones to do. He could either eliminate orders that he perceived his followers considered unpopular, maybe some of the executive orders that were written by President Obama during his tenure. That's relatively easy to change, some of them, most of them anyway. And then a bunch of others that can be written as new executive orders. But now it's time for him to do what has to be done to deliver on what would be the really tough promises. And these are tough not because there's not the will to do them. They're tough promises because these are the things that he's going to need the direct cooperation of another branch of government. Right now, most of what he's managed to achieve have been things that can be done with the authority of the executive branch, the White House. But now he's going to have to start dealing with Congress. The legislature is the House of Representatives and the Senate. And this is where every president has to go for the big money. A number of the major campaign promises that Donald Trump talked about for many, many, many months are going to require the spending of a lot of money. And that's where the rubber hits the road, and that's where he's going to run into some difficulties. The president is set to speak to what they call a joint congressional session tomorrow evening, and investors will, of course, be looking for any clues that they might get about the administration's plans for tax reform and deregulation. I mean, we've heard those terms used an awful lot, but what exactly do they mean? What are they going to be shooting for, and what are they going to be able to get from the House and the Senate? The House is where the money goes. You have to remember the leadership in the House, much of which was created as part of the Tea Party movement. Well, the Tea Party movement is big on fiscal conservatism, and they're not particularly inclined to taking on more debt. So that's going to be problematic, given that some of Donald Trump, the president's programs that he'd like to see put in place, some of his, as I said, major campaign promises are going to be very, very costly. What we're watching for, of course, is whether the focus of the president is going to be on pro-growth policies or on just a continuation of his populist method, his message that he's been offering. It seems like every time he gets up and you think you're going to get a policy discussion, you end up getting one more campaign stop. You know, he really specialized in that, and he became quite expert at, you know, getting up in front and really stirring up the crowd. And I know that he feeds on it. It gets his blood flowing. He enjoys it. The trouble is, it's like I said, it's a populist message. It feeds into only about 45% of the population is interested in that message. And the majority of the population that is out there is looking beyond the message and saying, well, they weren't necessarily supporters of his at the election time. But now that he's the president, they're looking for answers. They're saying, okay, what exactly are you going to do now? Can they, and maybe in the midst of it all, despite whether they supported the president or not, during the campaign, they're going to say, is there something good that we can find in the proposals he's making? And if there is something good in it, do we have the ability to pay for it? So we're looking, I suppose, in the president's speech tomorrow night for a reality check. Some realism, not just a continuation of the campaign. The campaign's over. He's the president of the United States now. Now he's going to start governing. And this is the hard part. Dow Jones Industrial Average did gain about 20 points today. It hit a new all-time high. Companies like Caterpillar and Chevron contributed the most to that gain. People are going to be cautious because the market has run up quite a bit, and it's run up on expectations of tax cuts and deregulation and the like. And it's going to be, as well as potential spending programs, such as infrastructure spending. Now, there are some things that we could get broad-based support on. I mean, we all agree that we need to be spending money on infrastructure. And if it's done correctly, it can, in fact, create jobs. It can spur or stimulate growth within the economy. But, of course, it's got to be paid for. So you're going to be looking at the Tea Party types from the House of Representatives in there saying, okay, show us the money. Don't just show us your idea for spending it. Show us where you're going to get the money from. And that's where the rubber will hit the road. We'll see possibly see a bit of a repeat of last week. The S&P 500 also hit a record high today before holding about a 0.1% higher move, with energy rising about 1% to offset some of the losses in telecom. NASDAQ Composite actually gained about 0.15% today. So it was, yeah, the market was up. It was just marginal. Not what we'd call conviction buying by any stretch of the imagination. But the major stock indices recorded fresh record highs last week, but did not really post gains as strong as the week before. So when they say, yeah, we may just get more of what we saw last week, they're saying, okay, higher highs, but not a dramatic momentum anyway in the movement. We've transitioned from an interest rates driven bull market to an earnings driven bull market. That's the main story, according to Jeffrey Sout, who's chief investment strategist over at Raymond James. He thinks that we've got perhaps another 6, 7, or 8 years in this bull market still left. So for those naysayers who that are out there saying, yeah, we're on the verge of a major correction or even a bear market, or I love to use the terms like a meltdown in the market, there's a lot of evidence out there still to this day that suggests, no, there's a bit of a way to run here. If you run the models closely, you could literally see numbers like 4,000 on the S&P. The president said Monday today at a meeting with governors, the administration will make the government lean and accountable. At around the same time, the Office of Management and Budget official told reporters that Donald Trump's first budget will call for a $54 billion hike in defense spending and an equal cut in what his administration deems lower priority programs. That's going to be interesting from the public's perspective as to find out what he considers low priority. Shares of Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin, of course, all climbed higher on the news, being military contractors. Policy updates and implementations of those orders are something which investors are looking for, obviously. The hopes are quite high, and the risk of disappointment is also equally dangerous for the market, in the United States anyway, which had another record high last Friday, according to chief market analyst over at Think Markets, and a number of different analysts that are out there are singing the same song, I guess, right now. In economic news, durable goods orders rose 1.8% for the month of January, slightly above the expected 1.7% increase. Pending home sales, in the meantime, dropped about 2.8% in January to the lowest level that we've seen in about a year. So I guess the persistent rise in home prices, well above the rate of inflation, on top of a higher cost of funding, have actually combined to moderate some of the home sales that we've been enjoying for a while here. And in addition to that, the Dallas Federal Reserve President, Bob Kaplan, a voting member of the Central Bank's Policymaking Committee, the Open Market Committee, he reiterated his view that a rate hike should come sooner rather than later. So the Fed is scheduled to actually hold its next monetary policy meeting on March the 14th, with the possibility of a rate hike high enough to keep investors at least intrigued. Market expectations for a rate hike in the month of March are right around 50-50. According to the Fed Funds Futures numbers. Folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa. This is AM 790, your home of talk and business, and we'll be right back. and we welcome you back to the Money Talk program here on AM 790. I'm Don Sower, delighted to have you here with me. Brett's here. He's our producer. If you got a question for me here on the show, you can actually give him a call at 437-5000. That is the local number, 437-5000. Toll-free number is 888-345-0790. That is 888-345-0790. If you're in your car and you can't speak, it's unsafe, just give your question to Brett. He'll plug it into my screen. If you are in a safe place, you're not driving, in other words, and talking on the phone, you know, feel free to let him know that, and he'll probably put you through as quickly as possible if there's more than one question involved with the conversation. We will do our best to respect your time and try to get you on as quickly as we can. U.S. Treasury yields rose after hitting a five-week low on Friday. What that means is when you say a low, Treasury yields, that means the dividend rate, the yield is dropping. And when the yield is dropping, it means the value of the bonds, the underlying bond, is going up. That can happen for a number of different reasons. But the benchmark 10-year note yield, right around 2.37%, and the 2-year note about 1.2. We've seen the note a lot lower than that. We've seen it a lot higher than that, depending upon the direction of dollar-based securities. The U.S. dollar erased earlier losses to trade about one-tenth of a percent higher against a basket of other currencies around the world. They trade all day long, with the euro near about 1.05 and the yen around 1.12. In corporate news, Goldman Sachs downgraded Tesla to a sell from a neutral. Delays in the large-scale production of the Model 3 are probably at the center of that downgrade. Tesla's stock declined about 5% in afternoon trading as a result. Wall Street also listened to CNBC's Squawk Box, wide-ranging interview, three-hour interview, by the way, by Becky Quick, with Warren Buffett, the legendary investor and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway. In it, Buffett said that the stock market is not in bubble territory, in his opinion, adding that prices are on the cheap side when you look at the prices in the environment of a very low interest rate environment. So, in other words, it's not as simple as people think. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 5 points, or 0.02 points, to 20,816, with Verizon leading decliners and Caterpillar the top advancer. But, as you said, later on as the day went on, the market improved. The S&P 500 fell less than a point to 2,366. And with telecommunications leading the five sectors lower, NASDAQ rose about 0.02% to 58.46. About nine stocks advanced for every five decliners in the New York Stock Exchange, with a exchange volume of about $353 million, or composite, in other words, across all the sectors, of almost 1.7 billion shares trading during the course of the trading day. You know, we talk about valuations and everybody wonders. They said, oh, the market's at an all-time high and it's set up for a meltdown. And well, you've got to understand this all-time high, the comparison that we're looking at for like the NASDAQ, the last time the NASDAQ was in the range, in the 5,000-plus range, was actually back in end of 1999, early 2000. So it's been like 16, 17 years to get us back to this high level you're talking about. But what makes the big difference here is that the market overall back in the first quarter of 2000, remember we were at the end of the dot-com bubble in the 90s, we were looking at price-to-earnings ratios, which is one of the metrics that we use to determine if the market's expensive. P.E. ratios that were in between 40 and 50. The long-term average price-to-earnings ratio for the broad market, not just the Dow, but a broad market, is probably in the range of 17 and 18 historically. Well, right now we are right around 20. So, yes, we're higher than the long-term average. But 20 is not particularly high by comparison. And it's nowhere near the highs that we were looking at back in the first quarter of 2000 when we last reached the all-time high levels that we're talking about here. So, in real terms, we're not in an extremely expensive, overbought market. It doesn't mean the market's cheap, let's be honest about that, but it doesn't suggest that there is no more fruit that can be picked. Maybe the low-hanging fruit's been picked, but the tree still has some fruit on it that you can get to if you're an investor, if you're a fruit picker. But the ultimately, if we see some growth in earnings, which will have some way, in fact, it's going to be affected by, of course, growth in the economy, that's where the expectations of higher prices can be achieved. And that's a little bit of what you've seen since the election on November the 8th with the Trump win in some of the areas that he has focused a lot of his energy and attention on, such as regulation reform, tax reform, and, of course, spending in key areas like infrastructure. There is a suggestion that goes along with that, that that will promote growth in the economy. Now, how fast the economy grows is a moot point. You don't have to try to be that picky in real terms. But, you know, when it really comes right down to it, the market itself doesn't have to grow 3 or 4%, although we've heard the president use that those numbers before. I don't think his own economists, remember, he admits that his own economists tell him not to use those numbers. But they don't have to go 3 to 4%. If the economy's been growing at 2% for the last 7 or 8 years, and with some of the policies that are being pushed forward in Washington now, if he's even able to get part of what he's looking for, just part of it, then ultimately the economy can grow, and it can grow, let's say we go from 2% to 2.5%, not even 3%, but 2.5%. Well, think about how much of a change that is. If you go from 2 to 2.5%, that means that you are actually growing by 25%. And that means that corporate earnings growth can be as high as a 25% increase. If you get a 25% increase in corporate earnings, then you can justify considerably higher prices on the stocks that these earnings represent. So, yeah, that's part of what the market is doing. The market, you've heard the old term, we've mentioned it here on the air, the market buys on the rumor and sells on the news. Well, I've changed the word rumor in news to the market buys on speculation of what can happen and sells on reality. Now, reality can be positive. But right now, speculation is suggesting that there are some forces at play in the early stages, admittedly. The early stages, admittedly, and it's not proven yet. But there's the possibility of these forces in play that can, spur economic growth. Again, you don't need 3 or 4%. If we get 2.5% growth rate in GDP, then we could justify higher prices than where we are right now. And it can be quite a bit higher than where we are. Jeremy Siegel, who's a Wharton Business School economist and a much awarded writer and thinker in the world of economics, much respected, he has suggested that, you know, even in the short term, where the Dow is in that 20,000 to 20,800 range, it could easily go to 22, 22.5 in the short term. And that's a 15 to 20% move from where we are now. So in the short term, we could be looking at another move from where we are of another 20%. You could get up to 22,000 or higher on the Dow based only on the metrics that we're looking at right now. He's not trying to stretch overly far. He's not one of those people that are saying, oh, we're going to go from 20,000 up to 40,000. But keep something in mind. If we're close to 20,000, in 10 years' time, if the market grows only at 7% per year, in 10 years' time, the Dow would be trading at 40,000. At a 7% rate of return, it takes 10 years to double in value. 7 is a good number. It's a number that I know a great many people would be probably ultimately, if you're paying attention, probably be very, very happy with your long-term average return of 7%. Realistically, if you factor out inflation and a few others, if you can get 5 or 5.5, you're doing very, very well. At those numbers, you could probably reach a great many of your goals depending upon one factor. And that factor is how much time do you have? 5 to 6% return over time can help you not get rich quick, but get rich slowly. And the word rich, of course, is going to be different from person to person that you talk to. But the definition by its design is to say that you will reach a point in your life, hopefully at a time when you no longer wish to work or maybe cannot work for one reason or another in your senior years, but have enough money to be financially independent, to be in control of the decisions that are made in your life. Where do you live? How do you live? With whom? Under what conditions? In other words, not have your lifestyle dictated to you by your circumstances or by somebody else. And I know dealing with a great many seniors now in my own practice as an investment advisor, I and a retirement specialist, what we look at is we see people who, when you say, well, what does a independent retirement mean to you? One of the very important factors for them is to be independent, yes, live where you want to live, retire when you choose, but very importantly, not be a burden on their children. they're looking at their adult children now who are raising their own children, their grandkids, and saying, you know, they've got so many challenges now. The world that they're entering into or that they're living in right now may not be as advantageous as the world that we lived in our early years, in our 30s, in our early 40s. So our ability, as baby boomers say, to acquire and accumulate the type of independent nest egg necessary to support a controlled, comfortable retirement, we had a better chance of doing that. Now, you could have failed. You might not have been if you weren't disciplined. You could have failed. Or you could be failing for a lot of different reasons. Look, I'm going to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to explain to you why a number of retirees, baby boomers or the next generation, why they have the potential to fail. A great many Americans are not using the resources available to them properly. We'll explain that right here in the second half of Money Talk. I'm Don Sower. I'll be right back. Yeah, we're back with the second half of tonight's show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Don Sowa, and this is Money Talk, right here on AM 790, your home of talk and business. You know, I mentioned before we went to break that there's a trend, and of course, related to independent retirement planning, a trend that has, made itself very visible and obvious. And it's one that we're running out of time to deal with, and that's the fact that Americans are not well positioned for retirement. Those who are on the verge of it or those who are approaching it, not particularly well set. The ones who have retired have found a way to do so. Sadly, you probably know some of those people, and the way they've chosen to retire is, of course, not to fully retire at all. Maybe they're working part-time in some capacity. I don't mind you working. I have a number of my own clients who work in their retirement years, in their 70s. But they do so because they love what they do. They do it because they love keeping busy. They feel it keeps them young. It keeps their minds vibrant. And they like the people that they work with. And that's an important part of it. The other thing that I found, and my father-in-law used to tell me this years ago, he used to say that most people, men and women alike, who've been long-time workers, have long-time working careers, they love the ritual. We are creatures of ritual. They love schedules. They love to get up in the morning at a certain time. The alarm doesn't even have to go off of these people. If they're somebody that gets up at 6:30 in the morning, you don't have to set the alarm for 6:30. Boom, 6:30. You get up. You look over the clock. Boom, it's 6:30. You're awake. Your body acts like a clock. And then you get up and you do the same things. You may even put your pants on the same way. It's an interesting dynamic. But in terms of how you get ready in the morning, and then come downstairs or go into the kitchen, and you follow the same routines. And I thought that was fascinating when he told me that. And that was a long, long time ago. And I've watched to see how I have myself, as I get older too, how my life and routine has become ritualistic. I have my own daily rituals that I tend to follow. But the biggest problem I think that we're going to have right now, if you're trying to acquire some level of control in your financial life, is you need to be saving more aggressively. And Americans simply are not saving enough money specifically for retirement. This has been, of course, a refrain for longer than many can remember. But now some disturbing numbers are starting to show. There are a lot of companies out there like Vanguard and Fidelity and T. Rowe Price and the AARP and a number of organizations that deal with seniors gathering a lot of data out there as to how their members, how people who now are eligible to be part of the AARP, you know, where do they stand financially? What is their attitude about money? What is their attitude about potentially retirement? 2/3 of all Americans don't contribute anything to a 401k plan or other retirement account available through their employer. 2/3. Millions aren't saving on the job because they either don't have access to a workplace retirement plan, or they, you know, do not, you know, they don't do it, but, you know, they have one, but they're not putting any money into it. And many just can't spare the cash. If you ask them, they say, look, I've got bills to pay and I got a lifestyle. What they're doing is they're focusing a lot more energy on their lifestyle, a lot more of their money on their lifestyle, not realizing that the money they should be putting away for retirement is not about their current lifestyle. Yes, I admit that. It's about your future lifestyle. It is about your future independence. But a new analysis shows that there are other reasons other than not just having spare cash. Until now, the exact size of this problem had been a little bit unclear. Surveys are sometimes unreliable, and they're sometimes biased. But small businesses are difficult to assess, especially, and so many employees in this country work for small businesses. And many workers just don't know what plan options they actually have, especially if employers aren't really making much effort to sign them up. Information on a 401k plan, for example, may be part of a stack of papers that are handed out on your very first day at work. A stack of papers that you either don't read or you're not really going to understand if you do read it. And ultimately, you set them aside and you never think about them again. And that's not a good thing, obviously. Now, U.S. Census Bureau researchers have come up with estimates that actually rely on tax data, which should be more reliable than surveys, of course. And the conclusion of this tax data, only about a third of workers are saving in a 401k plan or a similar tax-deferred retirement plan, like a 403b, 457, or even just putting money into your own individual retirement account. In addition to that, the gap is far wider than expected between the number of employers offering retirement plans and the number of workers saving in those plans. Census researcher Michael Gideon and Joshua Mitchell analyzed W-2 tax records from the year 2012 to identify 6.2 million unique employers and 155 million individual workers who held 219 million distinct types of jobs. This data produced estimates dramatically different from previous surveys that had been done. For example, previous estimates suggested more than 40% of private sector employers sponsored a retirement plan. 40%. Tax records uncovered a much bigger pool of small businesses, showing that overall just 14% of all employers, large and small, offer some sort of defined contribution plan, or like a 401k or a 403b if you're a nonprofit. So only 14% offer them. Bigger companies are the likeliest, of course, to offer a 401k plan. And since they employ more people than small firms, that will tend to skew the overall number of U.S. workers who have the option when you're trying to do a survey. Gideon and Mitchell's survey estimates that 79% of Americans work at places that do sponsor a 401k-style plan. The good news is that's more than 20% higher than previous estimates that they had. The bad news is that just 41% of workers at those employers are actually making contributions to the plan, more than 20%, 20 points lower than previous estimates that had been made. Now, the combined result of those two numbers is that just 32% of American workers are actually saving anything in a workplace retirement account. 4 out of 5 workers are employed by companies that offer a 401k plan or similar defined contribution plan, but most workers really are not using those plans. They're not having money taken out of their pay to fund their retirement plan, either because they're not eligible or because they aren't signing up for one reason or another. Sometimes it's what I call short-term, short-sighted selfishness. You're more selfish to support your current lifestyle than you are to ensure a future lifestyle. Because the future is out of sight and, yes, out of mind. Lawmakers have actually proposed a variety of ways to get more people to save. Several states are experimenting with strategies to get every worker signed up for a retirement account. But they face some serious pushback from the Republican-controlled Congress in the financial industry in general. Census researchers are still studying the tax data, cross-referencing it with other types of databases to get a fuller picture of how Americans are actually saving. For example, researchers are using retirement plan filing documents to get a better sense of how many workers are still covered by traditional pension plans, also known as defined benefit plans. That would be like a state-type plan that you work for a certain number of years at a certain level, and when you retire, you get a monthly check for the rest of your life. According to a Pew Charitable Trusts analysis of survey data released on February the 15th, only 10% of workers over the age of 22 have a traditional pension of any kind. Again, only 10% have a traditional defined benefit pension. These things are disappearing very, very fast. Just 6% of millennials have a pension, while 13% of baby boomers still have one. Not surprisingly, the census data suggests well-paid workers find it easier, of course, to save than the lower entry-level workers at any company, which makes sense, I suppose. But income isn't the only factor. Eligibility is also a major issue for part-time workers and people who change jobs frequently. Companies often require an employee to work for a certain amount of time, maybe a full year, before they can sign up for a 401k plan. And employers aren't really required to allow part-time workers into a plan unless they've worked about 1,000 hours during the previous year. So again, it's a question of qualifying sometimes, not just a lack of desire. Now, another problem made clear by the new report is that many workers simply don't know their company's 401k plan exists. Workers also might never get around to filling out the paperwork, even if their HR department has given the paperwork to them, or could be intimidated. Maybe they're intimidated or a little bit confused by the need to actually make investment decisions. Companies can help solve all of those problems by automatically signing up eligible workers, make it an auto-registration program, and requiring them to actually opt out if they don't want to participate. In other words, as soon as they are eligible to participate, they should be signed up automatically by the company. And then if they desire not to be in the plan, they have to opt out, as opposed to the other way around, which means they have to actually sign up if they want to. If they have the choice to sign up, they typically don't. If they have to opt out to avoid it, more people stay in the plans. Doing so has been proven to boost enrollment, but momentum has now stalled for automatic 401k plan features. We're talking right now about the issue of retirement, both baby boomers and millennials, coming up. There's a serious problem in this country, and if we are not independently on our own with the help of our companies doing something about it to save independently in our retirement plans, then we become wards of the state or the federal government. And as you're already starting to figure out, they simply don't have the money to support us in retirement. And Social Security is not supposed to be a retirement plan. It's just to assist you with spending and issues that you're trying to deal with in your life. It's not a full-blown pension. I'm Don Soh. We'll be back to see what's really happening out there and why, of course, the House of Representatives is trying to block auto enrollment plans. We think that that would be a good idea. This is Money Talk. I'm Don Soh on AM 790. I'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Money Talk. You know, in the last segment, we were talking about company-sponsored retirement plans like 401ks, and we mentioned that a number of employees do not participate, even though the company may have a plan. And one way to, of course, get more people participating and saving would have auto-enrollment, which means that as soon as you're eligible, however many months you have to work for the company itself enrolls you in the plan and sets some specific amount, maybe 5% of your pay or some number like that, to actually be withheld from your pay and go into the plan, and then you maybe have to make a choice as to where to put the money. Now, obviously, they can't force you to do anything, so you'd have to opt out of the plan if you simply didn't want to be in it. But they found in areas and in companies where they've had auto-enrollment, there's a larger percentage of employees that continue to participate long-term. Now, California, Oregon, Illinois, Maryland, and Connecticut have started programs designed to encourage workers to save. They know that the individual worker has got to be as independent financially as possible when they get to their retirement years. Otherwise, they're going to be dependent upon assistance from the government in order to pay their bills. Employers in those states would be required to either offer a retirement plan or automatically enroll their workers in a state-sponsored individual retirement account. Now, the states had the blessing of the Obama administration at the time, which issued rules allowing states and even large cities to create portable retirement accounts if they want to. The Pension Portability Act was part of that mix. On February the 15th, however, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to rescind those rules, echoing the arguments of the financial industry Republicans argue that state auto enrollment plans constitute unfair competition to the financial industry itself. Now, if the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate and President Trump, of course, also sign off, any state and city auto IRA plans would be placed in jeopardy. And there'd be a lot of people who probably simply would not be participating, saving money for retirement. That's the point. Whatever the outcome, any effort to get workers to save for retirement faces a daunting challenge. Can Americans spare the money? Student debt, over $1 trillion now. And auto loans are at record levels, according to Federal Reserve data released February 16th. And overall consumer debt is rising at the fastest pace we've seen in 3 years. Now, retirement is an important goal, but many Americans seem to have more pressing short-term financial needs. Because W-2's record tax-deferred retirement contributions, Gideon and Mitchell, the survey people, were able to identify actually how many businesses offer plans and how many workers at those firms are saving in tax-deferred types of accounts. It's a big challenge. It's a big issue, no matter how you look at it. In real terms, you have to provide incentives for people to save. The issue of a match by the company. A great many 401k plans do, in fact, have some sort of a matching provision where they will say, look, we'll give you 50 cents on the dollar up to 6%, so that if you were to have 6% of your pay withheld and put into the company plan, then the company itself will also kick in another 50 cents on the dollar, which would be another 3%. So instead of putting away 6%, you'd have an amount equal to 9% going into your program. And again, the earlier you start this, the greater the chances are that you will get to your 60s and into normal retirement age and be financially independent. Now, the next generation, my children's generation, the children of the baby boomers and beyond, who are now in their 30s and older, you know, they're in an unusual position, no matter how they look at it. They have time, which is one thing that the baby boomers who haven't saved enough don't have. If you're already in your late 50s, early 60s, or beyond, and you have not put away money for retirement, there's very little you can do in terms of your choices. You're going to maybe be eligible for some Social Security if you participated in the plan, but of course, how much money you had withheld is a direct result of how much you earned and how much was taken out of your pay under the FICA provisions. Now, that's fine, but remember, Social Security by its very nature was never designed to accommodate more than a third of the cost of actually a traditional average retirement in the United States. Now, that said, we're looking at numbers in the $1,500 to $1,800 a month range, and that would mean that the average income in retirement from all sources would be somewhere in the $2,600, $2,700 a month range, but you know, only part of it is going to come from Social Security. And if you're not going to, what are you going to do otherwise? If you haven't saved money either in a regular traditional savings program or in a plan that's designed for you to save money, an investment-related type plan. And remember, you don't have to have a company-related plan. If you don't have a plan at your company, you can set up an IRA. If you're under 50, you could put $5,500 away into the IRA. If you're over 50, you can do a catch-up where it's over $6,500. But you can have money put aside to the tune of $450 or $500 per month. And you can have it come right out of your paycheck, go right into your checking account at the bank, and then you can have the checking account draft that $500 directly into the individual retirement account that you've set up. Now, all you need to do at this point is decide what kind of an account that personal account should be. But, you know, $500 a month or the equivalent of $250 out of each paycheck, that's a pretty decent amount of money. The only negative you'll have in a personally structured plan is that you don't have a company match. And the rule of thumb on a company match is, when they say, how much money should I put away into a company? The amount that they're willing to match you. If they're willing to match up to 6%, then please put up to 6. If you can put away 10%, take the other 4 above the 6 that you're going to put away and get matched, and put that 4 into a personally set up Roth IRA. You won't get a deduction for it, but it will grow tax-free, and when it comes out eventually in retirement, it'll come out tax-free. And I promise you, you'll be very, very happy at that time when you have tax-free revenue. in retirement. Folks, I'm Don Sowa. This has been Money Talk. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in tomorrow. Donna Sowa, Allard, and myself will be here for the Get Back to Basics program right here on AM 790. So have a good night.